Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here on our first case of 2020-182, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow versus the Ohio State Board of Education et al. I will start at the beginning of this case by noting that Judge Scott Gwynn from the Fifth District Court of Appeals is joining us this morning in place of Justice Jennifer Bruner. Welcome, Judge Gwynn.
Good morning.
All right, we will begin with the appellant, Mr. Little.
May it please this honorable court, Mr. Clark. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before the court is fairly straightforward. It is whether or not a community school has the right to pursue a Chapter 119 appeal from an adverse determination made by the Ohio Board of Education as part of a quasi-judicial decision-making process. I would submit there are two statutes that are key to the court's analysis that I'll briefly introduce, but there's another point that I think is more salient to the court's consideration. The statutes, of course, are 3301.13, which provides an overarching framework for the court's consideration of this issue because that statute expressly states that with respect to all actions and powers exercised by the Department of Education, the Board of Education, that it is subject to Chapter 119. The second statute, of course, that is relevant to the court's consideration is 3314.08K2D, which this court in a prior decision, the Brookwood matter, has had an opportunity to consider that. And in fact, right on the specific word that is at issue today, what does final mean? In that particular case, the court said final means simply a final determination by the agency. It does not mean that there is no further appeal recourse available. Now, those particular statutes should not be divorced from the specific context of this case and the multiple concessions made by the respondent. And there are two key concessions made by the respondent that I submit are helpful to the court's analysis. The first, that this is a quasi-judicial process that was undertaken before the Board of Education. And that's important to note because we know under the statute 3314.08, it makes reference to there being an informal proceeding. But make no mistake here, the proceeding that was conducted before the hearing officer involved the taking of evidence, receipt of evidence by exhibits and the swearing in of witnesses, and then a very formal opinion issued from which there were then objections filed. So it was a quasi-judicial process, according to the Department of Education, based upon the day of the week. And I say that that's important because pre-ECOT, the Department of Education's position was, the Board of Education's position was, that this would be a process by which there would be a quasi judicial decision rendered, an appeal right would exist under 119. During the course of the chapter, the proceedings involving ECOT, the department changed its position. The Board of Education changed its position and said, lo and behold, this is no longer a quasi-judicial process. Lo and behold, this is no longer a process by which anyone's entitled to take a Chapter 119 appeal. When we appropriately pointed out, if that was the case, they violated the Open Meetings Act. The Department of Education and Board of Education pivoted at that point in time and then finally took the position that was accepted by the 10th District Court of Appeals that this is a quasi-judicial process. Now, that's the first admission that is significant. The second is that the department and the board have each represented to this court that we're entitled to a Chapter 119 appeal. And as the court knows, at the time of the adverse determination, we followed a dual approach in trying to seek further relief. We filed a writ of mandamus before this court. And as part of that, there was a writ of mandamus, writ of prohibition component. We also filed a Chapter 119 appeal before the Common Pleas Court. And why did we do that? Very simple. Again, it depended upon the day of the week, what position the Board of Education was taking as to what our rights were for further review. And so we appropriately pursued both courses of action. And in response to the mandamus action, the board filed a motion to dismiss before this court. Now, I think it's important to understand the context of that motion. They filed a Rule 12 motion. And we know that the civil rules apply to original proceedings before this court, unless otherwise stated under its rules. So when they file a Rule 12 motion, that means all allegations in the complaint have to be construed in our favor. They advanced three arguments. The first argument was that a writ of prohibition action was unavailable because there was not a question or challenge to jurisdiction. The second argument they advanced in those papers, Your Honor, was that there was we had a right to a Chapter 119 appeal, very issue we're litigating today. And as a result, there was an adequate remedy of law, so there was a mandamus could not be heard. And then the third argument they advanced in their motion to dismiss was that they believed and they put in evidence, and both parties submitted evidence, they argued that they had not abused their discretion. Well, we know under a Rule 12C context, it would not have been appropriate to simply have taken their words at face value, nor would have been appropriate to try to resolve differences as to the evidentiary issues at that point in time. So the only real basis that could have been permissibly basis for this court's decision dismissing the mandamus was accepting the state's position that we're entitled to an administrative appeal. So those are two admissions that I think are substantial to the court's consideration. And yet today, predictably, once the case, this court dismissed the mandamus action and we were before the common pleas court, the department—
I don't quite understand the argument that the court's basis had to be that there was an adequate remedy. Why couldn't it have been that under the language of the statute, there was no clear legal right to the relief requested?
Well, that wasn't the issue, with all due respect, Your Honor, that was raised as part of that mandamus action. Certainly, we have litigated before this court before what is the statutory authority of the Department of Education in terms of how to calculate funding. And this court has already resolved that issue. That was not the issue that was raised as part of the mandamus action. What the issues that were raised by the administrative action related to the arbitrary and unreasonable conduct of the department, as to even if you accept, as the court held, that they had the statutory right to determine funding and the methodology they were proposing, they had not followed the basic rules of administrative law in doing so. They have did so on a retroactive basis. They did so without giving notice. They did so without setting forth standards. These are all the things that we have pointed out for some many years now were the problems with their approach. And of course, the auditor, now attorney general, has echoed the same complaints we have in his report, making findings that the Department of Education did not provide appropriate notice to the community schools as to the changing and the methodology determinations. So to go back to your original question, Justice DeWine, that issue was not before the court. So a conclusion by this court—
Well, how was it not before the court? I mean, that's one of the requirements for a mandamus action, that you have to show a clear legal right to the relief requested, right? A clear legal duty.
Well, there was two differences there. One, if you're asking whether or not it was a question of simply saying the Department of Education had the ability to adopt this type of variation of funding determination, again, that was not what was raised. As to the remaining things, there is, I think, a clear basis under the law, and we've cited some of those cases in our brief, that sets forth we were entitled to the type of protections and the record was undisputed, we did not receive them. So I think that is a clear violation of the law that would have supported a denial of the motion for mandamus relief. But again, their argument was that their third argument was that they were asserting the position that they possessed discretion. There was not an abuse of discretion. So they were in agreement with us as to what the standard was. It wasn't a question of clear duty or not. It was a question of whether they were asserting that they had not abused their discretion in the decision-making process.
But a clear legal duty is always a requirement of a mandamus action, right?
That much is true. What it's when we went back then to the common pleas court, then we saw the catch-22 situation that the department was trying to play, in which on the one hand, we could not have any matter considered as part of mandamus, and then on the other hand, they could not have any matter considered under Chapter 119. There's obviously complete inconsistencies in the position taken by the state, but the resolution of these issues, I would submit to the court, is simply a matter now of statutory resolution. Again, we have several basic propositions that dictate how the statute should be read. And the first is, I think, the simplest, which is we have Chapter 119 or 3301.113, which is remedial in nature. And when it is remedial in nature, any dispute or confusion or conflicts as to whether we're entitled to an appeal should be resolved in our favor. And indeed, that what's important to emphasize is a 3301.13, it is unique under Ohio law. We have canvassed the authorities and detailed this in the footnotes of our brief, but that is a unique provision under the revised code in terms of the obligations it imposed upon the appellees in terms of their compliance with Chapter 119. There is no provision in that section for carve-outs that says you do not have to honor or you can preclude any type of appellate rights. In fact, the issue that ultimately is joined is, does the provisions of 3301.113, are they somehow trumped by 3314.08(k)(2), and I would submit to the court the answer is readily no. Once again, when we revert back to the Brookwood decision where the court was confronted, what does the term final mean? Does it mean that there is no appellate review available, or does final have a meaning much like you would at the trial court level, that there is now a final judgment that has been reached from which then an appeal can then be pursued. And if we simply follow the Brookwood authority, and I understand Brookwood had certain different dynamics, but we cannot deny what the ultimate finding was in Brookwood. If we simply apply that in the context of 3301.113, I would submit to the court, it results in only one conclusion. In fact, there's only one conclusion that allows the court to read these statutes consistently, because the department position taken by the state is they want to identify an inconsistency, so then they can argue about that. There's no reason for inconsistency when you can read them together, which reaches the conclusion that we're entitled to a Chapter 119 appeal. Thank you.
Mr. Little, let me ask you one question, if I could, and that is, do you concede that the determination on the writ was a determination on the merits of that action?
I do not.
Okay.
You can conclude that there is no jurisdiction. Again, we have the court's entry speaks for itself. It's one line, so it's not my prerogative to venture a guess as to the thought process. But when I go through and look at what the three arguments were that were presented by the state, I can easily eliminate the third category because this was a Rule 12 motion. So that leaves us simply to the issue about whether or not there was an adequate remedy of law. If there's an adequate remedy of law, I don't view that a determination on the merits. That is simply, that means the remedy of a mandamus is not available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Clark.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. Case law is clear that when a statute creates the administrative proceeding and then says that the determination based upon that proceeding is, quote, final, and then does not specifically grant a Chapter 119 appeal, there is no Chapter 119 appeal. Instead,
so why did you argue the opposite way on the mandamus action?
We did not, Your Honor.
You did argue adequate remedy, right?
No, Your Honor. We argued that they were seeking a 119 appeal at that time, and they should not be able to seek both. All parties agree it's one or the other. Our argument,
right? But I mean, that seems a little disingenuous, right? I mean, to say that they, I mean, to oppose, to say they can, you're essentially saying they can't seek either one. I mean, they have some right to challenge this.
Not at all. So we argued, Your Honor, that they cannot seek mandamus review while also claiming in the court below that they have a right to 119.
Well, isn't it pretty clear that someone can argue for alternative remedies? I mean, how else would they protect their rights?
You can't. Well, two answers. First, alternative remedies need to be alternative, not both. That's one problem. And then number two, they could have sought to stay the mandamus action if they felt that their 119 appeal had any.
I keep reading that in your briefs, but why does whether or not they sought to stay it matter to the legal merits of the claim?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a response to their allegations that we were somehow inconsistent, when in fact it was ECOT that was seeking both bites at the apple while conceding that they should only have one. I would agree that it's not
relevant. Well, I mean, you both kind of took inconsistent positions, right? I mean, they couldn't, they only had a right to seek one remedy or the other. They just didn't know what it was. So, I mean, it's understandable why they took inconsistent positions. It's a little less hard to understand. It's a little harder to understand why the state wouldn't have a position about what the proper way to challenge this is.
What we argued in the mandamus action is that we would be seeking to dismiss the 119-12 appeal because there's no right to 119-12 appeal here. We were clear both in this case and in the mandamus case, but made the additional point in mandamus that they can't come and seek mandamus in the situation in which they were also seeking a 119.12 appeal. But I would agree, Your Honor, that ultimately the procedural posture of this case isn't relevant to the question before the court. It's simply a matter of statutory interpretation that's going to apply regardless of the procedural posture of one particular case.
So, counsel, what is their remedy for appeal? How would you afford them a right of appeal? Through what vehicle?
It would be through an original action in mandamus, Your Honor, which they did file here, and it was dismissed. And I will say that, as Mr. Little said, we do not know the basis on that dismissal. But our motion to dismiss the mandamus brought up not only the inconsistency of seeking mandamus while also seeking 119.12 as a basis for dismissal, but also on the merits. And we cannot possibly, we argue that it was dismissible under Rule 12, you know, using the standards that would apply in a Rule 12 motion. Certainly ECOT argued that we couldn't get dismissal, but it is entirely possible that this court, especially given the fact that the majority of our brief was on the merits and not on the procedural aspect, that this court did in fact hear ECOT's claims on the merits and found them subject to dismissal based on nothing having to do with jurisdiction. Of course, we can't argue.
It is conceivable that we dismissed it because they have a 119 appeal.
It is, Your Honor, and we wouldn't try. I think ECOT is attempting to try to you know, read the tea leaves and explain something that this court did not decide.
Well, are we doing the same thing?
No, Your Honor, we are not asserting that we can divine that this court in fact dismissed on the merits. All we're saying is we don't know.
Okay, I'll give you that.
And ultimately, it doesn't matter because ultimately the question before this court is a statutory interpretation question.
Counsel, let me ask you about that. So when decisions are rendered at the Common Pleas Court, typically they say this is a final and appealable order. So the parties know that everything's been disposed of that was in dispute, and you can move to the next step of appealing if the adverse party wants to, and or the party receiving the adverse decision. Why wouldn't the legislature, if it intended to make this unappealable, simply have said that clearly, this is a final and unappealable order?
Your Honor, there are essentially, you could put all of the statements in statute that label a decision, an agency decision final, into essentially three groups. Sometimes they say final and not appealable. Sometimes they say final. And sometimes they say final and appealable. And so ECOD argues that, well, you could have said final and not appealable. That would have solved it. So since you didn't, it must mean appealable. But the same thing goes the other way. The General Assembly could have said final and appealable, as it has on other occasions, and it did not do that.
So we're supposed to just take the middle road, which is the final. It's just final with no non-appealable or appealable, and divine that it means non-appealable.
For two reasons, Your Honor. First, it's the settled law of the 10th District, at least, which hears the vast majority of agency appeals. But also it makes sense from, two other reasons. First of all, we should take the ordinary meaning of a word. And when people walk around and think of the word final, they're thinking about the end of the road. They're thinking about no more process. That means nothing, it's the end. That's what final means. In Brookwood was faced with a very specific situation, which was the word final but nothing more was used in 3314.015b3. And then two subdivisions later, right next to it, it said that the decision may be appealed pursuant to chapter 119. In that situation, this court had to figure out what to do with the word final, since its ordinary meaning wouldn't work. And so it said, we'll revert to the secondary technical meaning, the meaning you are not supposed to use in interpreting statutes unless it becomes necessary. And in Brookwood, it became necessary. And it's important to understand too, in Brookwood, 3301.13 was at issue in that case too. It was a decision of the State Board of Education. And this court specifically noted 3301.13, on which ECOT relies directly. And this court did not find that 3301.13 answered the question. This court said, quote, the crux of this case is the interplay between 0.015d3, final, and 0.015d may appeal. This specific decision may be appealed. That, according to this court, the language makes all the difference. The difference from what? The difference from the entire line of 10th District cases that found that the word final and nothing more meant no Chapter 119 appeal. This court in Brookwood considered those decisions from the 10th District and did not reject the 10th District's reasoning. Instead, it distinguished the Brookwood statute specifically because right after it said final regarding the exact same agency decision, it said and appealable. So the real distinction is between whether it says final and appealable or not. And if it does not use and appealable in some way regarding that specific decision, then you go to the ordinary meaning of final.
So if the board in this case would have, let's say, arbitrarily disregarded the evidence and ruled that ECOT didn't owe anything back, made a decision like that, you're telling me you would be here conceding that you have to live with that, with no right to review an arbitrary decision?
Your Honor, I would say first that if the state board overrides its own hearing officer, I'm not sure I would say that we would be in a position to challenge that. I think we'd respect the state board as state, but in any event, if the school itself, if that arbitrary thing happened, which of course we don't believe at all was the case here, then ECOT is not without recourse. Throughout its brief, ECOT talks about the fact that, you know, there's no judicial review, but it concedes that there's just a different avenue through an original action in mandamus, which it pursued, and which it very well, okay, and we don't know, but very well may have been heard on. And even if it was not, that was its own making by seeking both avenues when it knows it can only seek one. And I want to just...
Well, I mean, I guess I have a tough time with that, because if they had filed one or the other, the state would have opposed it, saying they should have filed the other one, right?
No, Your Honor, we took the...
So if they had just filed a mandamus action, you're telling me the state wouldn't have said they have a right to appeal?
That is correct, Your Honor. We only argued in mandamus that they can't seek both. which they did, which disqualified them from going forward in mandamus. We would not, in fact, in the mandamus action itself, not in the appeal, in the mandamus action itself, we made clear to this court that we would be arguing that there is no 119 appeal.
I don't understand that argument that you oppose, that they can't seek both. Okay. Well, then the remedy there would be to dismiss the one that they weren't allowed to seek. It wouldn't be to stop them from pursuing a mandamus action if they didn't have a valid appeal.
Well, Your Honor, I think that we felt that there was a danger of essentially parallel judicial review when it's clear from the case law, ECOD itself would concede you can only have one.
Well, why wouldn't the state just say that? So say the state's position is that this can only be reviewed in mandamus. So we're going to litigate the mandamus claim, and we're going to oppose the appeal.
Well, I think we certainly said that we would oppose the appeal, even in the mandamus action. If the state was wrong to seek full dismissal on the basis of their claiming no adequate remedy at law while seeking an adequate what would be an adequate remedy at law according to their own reasoning, if full dismissal is not available given that procedural context, then that's fine, but that doesn't change the fact that I think that we were consistent in pointing that we would always be arguing that there was no 119.12 review available. Meanwhile, ECOD are in its notice of appeal in the 119 appeal said that it was appeal. It said out of an abundance of caution, it was conditionally filing this appeal to preserve its rights in the event.
That seems pretty clear, right? I mean, what else would a good lawyer do in that position?
If ECOT thought that it had a 119.12 appeal, then it shouldn't file mandamus. And if ECOT,
but then it had the risk the state would say, you don't have a 119.12 appeal. You should have filed a mandamus, and you blew it. So
they can do a couple of things. First of all, it was not they had more time to file a mandamus action. They did not need to seek both at the same time. They could have waited to see what happened with the 119.12 appeal. Second, they could have tried to stay the mandamus action, but instead sought emergency expedited relief on the mandamus action. And so our concern was simply that we didn't want to have two courts deciding the same thing at the same time when it's clear you can't. But I would just want to just go
counsel,
back to-
if we buy your argument on the 119 appeal here today, are you willing to concede that the decision on the mandamus action was not a decision on the merits and that they have a right to pursue that mandamus action?
Your Honor, we believe, I do not know what this court's basis for dismissing the mandamus.
Well, you've already conceded that they have a right to one or the other. And so it seems to me that there's a one-line dismissal in regard to the mandamus action. Taking your argument here today and hypothetically giving it merit on the 119 appeal, it seems to me that you then are conceding that they would have the right to go back and pursue a mandamus action because the decision on that issue was other than on the merits previously rendered by this court.
No, Your Honor, I think that the decision that was already made in the mandamus action just as well could have been on the merits as jurisdictional. And for that reason, we would not concede that they get to do a second mandamus action when they have already been heard on the merits or potentially. The fact that, excuse me, I see my time has expired.
Go ahead.
The fact that ECOT took this procedural approach shouldn't give it the potential of two bites at the apple. We just don't know on the record what this court did. And it's important to understand that, of course, this court speaks through its writings. And so we're just left ultimately with the pure statutory question of whether or not when a statute calls a decision final, that somehow that still allows
Counsel, are you saying that the word final in the statute is the carve out that takes this proceeding out of the field of 119 and 30 or 330113? In other words, both of those statutes say that there is the right to appeal. 330113 says subject to 119 of the revised code, that the statute or the Department of Education exercise any of the function. Okay, the Department of Education and any office or agency shall be subject to 119. And then 119 says any party adversely affected by any order of any agency issued pursuant to any other adjudication may appeal to the Court of Common Pleas in Franklin County. And are you saying because the word final is used in another statute, that takes this proceeding out of the realm of those two statutes?
Yes, Your Honor, under settled law of statutory construction,
okay,
which says—
all right, wait a minute. Because the only way that that can happen is if we read final the way you're reading it.
Right, but the only way that you can give meaning to both provisions is if you read them in concert. And
what provisions? Wait a minute, what provisions?
So 3301.13, Your Honor, is the general earlier statute, which says, you know, any, all.
Right.
And then 3314.08K is the one that specifically says final, which under settled case law that this court has not disturbed, standing alone means no appeal. And you can read those, you have to, according to revised code 151 in the motor carrier case, read those in concert. And that means that the later specific statute is treated as an exception to the earlier general statute. The same analysis would apply in the 119, you know.
Okay, but we're not bound by final meaning what you say it is, just because we have got 10th district cases, correct?
Of course not, Your Honor. This court will decide what the word final means, but this court has already considered that line of reasoning in the Brookwood case and did not disturb it. Instead, and specifically noting 3301.
Well, there were other statutes involved in Brookwood, and Brookwood did allow for the appeal, based on the two statutes in play in Brookwood.
Importantly, Your Honor, based upon a different statute in 015D, that pointed to the express 119 appealability of that particular decision of the agency right after it mentioned the word final. That was the narrow exception that caused this court to say, well, now we need to go back and think about what final could mean other than its obvious ordinary meaning.
Well, in that case, it says, thus in our system of law, final can mean the opposite of not appealable.
Exactly, Your Honor. This court, in trying to figure out what final could mean when followed by the words and appealable, said, okay, we understand now that final in the technical term of appellate law can sometimes mean ready for appeal. But absent that specific and appealable language following the word final, this court has not disturbed the settled case law of, you know, saying that final standing alone means what the ordinary meaning of final always should be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask one more question, Chief?
Yes, sure.
What if we, looking back, decide that we did in fact dismiss the earlier action because we accepted the argument that there was a Chapter 119 appeal? Now that the issue has been briefed, we think that first decision was wrong, and we agree with the state. There's no 119 appeal. So then, what do we do?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not sure I understood the question. If
what if the basis of our first dismissal? What if we're convinced the basis of the first dismissal was that we believed there was an adequate remedy of law? Now that the matter has been briefed and new arguments presented that weren't presented initially, that we agree with the state that the right remedy was a mandamus, then what do we do?
Well, the first, I think I have two answers, Your Honor. The first is that it's not unheard of that a party might be on the losing side of inconsistent issues at two different points in time under law. And generally speaking, we don't go back and fix some mistake of law that a court made prior to benefit whoever lost in that earlier case. So there's no automatic problem if that were to be the case. But the second point is, I don't believe this court can go back, you know, in the context of this appeal and assign meaning to the one line dismissal one way or the other, whether in our favor or ECOT's favor, because the court speaks through its decisions. And it's typical, we understand that this court dismisses mandamus even on merits without any reasoning. And so, and at the end of the day, a new court with new members, or even a court with the same members, cannot be certain exactly what each individual justice used as his or her final reasoning for a decision. Instead, it has to be based upon what was actually written at the time. So I don't think going back and assigning meaning officially to what is not explained in the mandamus dismissal is an option for this court. At the end of the day, the case is simply about whether 3314.08K precludes 119 review. Again, a question that will be answered for administrative proceedings beyond this case and beyond this school. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Little.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple final points. The first one, and I don't want to belabor this, but again, to make clear, as set forth in some detail in the brief, the procedural position that ECOT has taken across these various cases has been dictated in response to the specific positions taken by the Department of Education, the Board of Education. They've set forth various positions. They've been inconsistent. We've done our best to try to respond to them, but admittedly, it's a struggle. But as it was explained to Justice DeWine, we even would make our notices of appeal conditional because we simply did not know what position the department was going to take on any particular day of the week. And I think the answer to the last question proves the point. The answer they give will be the one that they think will finally reach a conclusion so that there is no review of what has occurred here. And I think that's important when you consider a separation of power analysis in terms of an administrative agency conducting quasi-judicial processes in which they're submitting that as a practical matter, they are not going to afford any form of review to the aggrieved party. And I think that's inconsistent with our jurisprudence. Let's talk a moment again and simply as to the statutory construction. I think it's simple because counsel keeps saying the words should be construed a certain way. We start off with the proposition that when you're trying to deny someone a right of appeal, when we have the benefit of remedial statute, the presumption is there is a right of appeal. So the question is, how do you create an exception? And the court's authority is clear that if you want to create an exception to a right of appeal, that exception must be explicit. Here it is not explicit. We certainly have countless examples that are cited in the revised code where the General Assembly, where it wanted to be explicit in denying a party right of appeal, expressly stated that. Here it did not. And I understand counsel's argument as it relates to the court's prior decision in Brookwood, but Brookwood can't simply have one meaning in one context, and then at that particular construction, the word final can have no application anywhere else. There, in fact, was a particular pathway or analysis that drew compelled the court's conclusion. But at the end of the day, the court did say that final, as used in the very section we were discussing today, has a meaning of simply concluding the proceedings at that level. It did not foreclose any type of appeal. So if we simply apply what I think are fairly straightforward rules of construction, starting off with there is a presumption of access, again, there is only one construction that is going to allow you to reconcile 3301.13 with 3314.08. We don't have to try to say that the specific trumps the general. We simply have to say you read them consistently. And if you do, then ECOT does have a Chapter 119 right of appeal. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.